Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, my fan friends. Welcome to another Rahala Stapa, this week from Exeter with the amazing Professor Francesca Stavrakopoulou. All about the Bible. You're going to love it. I promise you. It's great. She's fantastic. Exciting news for coming up, Rahala Stapa. As you may have heard, we're doing a run of 5 weeks in London, March the 9th. My guest will be Sir Michael Palin. Yes. At last, my dreams have all come true. Imagine if I fuck it up and make him unhappy, how funny that will be. I'm very much hoping I will not do that. It's all my dreams come true. Of course, the tickets have sold out, and we're aiming for that kind of guest for every show. So it's worth booking ahead. Go to richchang.com/gigs every Monday in March and April the 6th in London, March the 28th. In Birmingham. That one's selling very fast. It might even be sold out by the time you see this. No guests announced for that yet. Norwich already sold out. There will be more dates added in the second half of the year. So why not come and see it live? richardherring.com/gigs. Become a badger and you'll hear about the guests before everyone else. This Michael Palin gig sold out before it had been announced to the general non-badge scum populace. So go to gofasterstripe.com/badges. You get all kinds of other extras. I've told you about them a million times. Why don't you ever listen to me? £3 a month would really help us make loads more podcasts. So please go to gofasterstripe.com/badges if you enjoy these podcasts. And if you can't afford to pay, don't pay. You could pay us back by recommending especially the audio podcasts to other people. Every 1,000 or so people who listen to those gives us about 5p from the advertising. So come on. Let's do it, my fan friends. Help us out that way. Look, let's fuck off. Relax, sit back, and enjoy Rahala Stapa with Professor Francesca Stavrakopoulou. I didn't even have to read it. I knew it off by heart. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Corn Exchange in Exeter. Please welcome a man who has come with some corn to exchange. Can't wait to find out what he's going to get for it. It's Richard Herring. Hello! Hello, Exeter! This is the furthest southwest I'm prepared to come. Fuck you, Plymouth.
Yeah, fuck you. Unless you travelled up to see me here, that's nice of you, but... And Cornwall can fuck off as well. So it's... Too far. Even this is too far away. It is lovely to be here. The Corn Exchange. This is the most modern Corn Exchange I've ever seen. This is usually an ancient thing. This Corn Exchange was built in 1983 by the looks of it. People thought, oh, should we have a Corn Exchange next to see what... So people can bring in Corn Exchanges, like Swap Shop. Change it for other bits of corn. Similar bits of corn. Welcome to Richard Herring's Languorous Sunday Torpor podcast. You've got to come up with a new thing every time you do this. Come up with a new angle now for podcasts. So I thought I would do a podcast 3 days after the last one in Winchester. I'm pretty tired. My son's had his second birthday party yesterday. I'm fucked. I've got no idea what's going on. This is honestly like being on some kind of amazing drug. I might be talking to myself in a room. To be honest, at the moment, I'm quite tired, is what I'm saying, but it's going to be fine. I was talking to Gus Honeybun, though, the other day. We're very much in the catchment area for that. And he was doing some bunny hops with me. My friend Brian Buncroft had Gus Honeybun on his 11th birthday, a bit sad. He calls it Relispus. I don't know if that's going to... pretty cool, magic button. It is great to be in Exeter. It's a beautiful city, and there's not much to take the piss out of here, I have to say. I'm going to give it a go. It's going to be hard for me. I like it. I was looking at the local news. I looked at that everywhere, and it's very slow-paced here in Exeter. I would like to... The local news today is that blood was left on the street after a late-night incident outside the Tesco Metro last night. I don't know if you saw. Did anyone see the... Blood. I mean, the way that's reported, it sounds like someone's just come and left like a cup of blood on the floor for any passing vampires. It's not known how the blood found its way there. That is, if anyone knows, it was cleaned up at 9:30 a.m. That is the Exeter news. We're living in the middle of a city. Someone's cut themselves. It is an exciting place. You used to have the oldest hotel in the country. Still a little bit of it left. You had the funniest terrorist attack there has ever been in Exeter, so well done for that. Where a man attempted to suicide bomb a branch of giraffe in Exeter. I mean, it was very niche. It was always going to be very niche. Thankfully, he didn't work, although he did manage to... It's a comedy terrorist attack because he blew himself up in the toilet and didn't even kill himself. So, on that occasion. So, it's... He is now dead. You'll be glad to hear. He didn't take anyone with him. So that's Exeter. That was the most exciting thing that's happened in Exeter. A house moved down the street. That was in 1961. They still talk about it. It's got the narrowest street in the world, Parliament Street, allegedly. I think they put that sign up and found out it wasn't true, so changed their minds. And the house to move, that's all. And some tunnels underground that got quite a lot of one-star reviews from people on TripAdvisor who seemed disappointed that the tunnels were quite small and wet. Anyway, we're going to crack straight on with our only guest this week, that we only have one guest a week, as you know, and... She's probably best known for being the author of The Prophet Haldar and The Stuff of State. That's why we're all here. I hope you all read that before you came out, because that is all we're going to be talking about. Please welcome from Exeter University, Professor Francesca Stavrakopoulou, ladies and gentlemen.
Welcome. Right back here. Come and sit down.
What's the best bit? What's the take-home bit in The Prophet Haldar and The Stuff of State? Would you say what was the...
I love it that you've picked out probably one of my most obscure publications.
I did.
Yeah,
I'm
really pleased that you did that. the most important thing is that she's a woman and that she's got a name in the Bible, because there's not many of them. So that's quite important. But I've got an interesting fact for you. I was listening to you just now.
Yes.
And you were talking about Parliament Street being the littlest street in Exeter.
Yes.
It used to be called something different. It was renamed.
It did, and I saw this.
You know this. I'm amazed you've not mentioned it.
It used to be called Tiny Poo Street.
No.
But I did look this up and I can't remember. Go on, what would tell me?
Cunt Grape Street.
Oh, was it one of those? No, yeah. I didn't get that.
Mum. Damn, I've done it already.
I don't remember that. You didn't predict you would be ruder before I was. So well done. You've succeeded. So you are what's your official title? You're the professor?
Professor of Hebrew Bible and Ancient Religion. So yeah. Basically, Hebrew Bible is what other people call the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And ancient religion is religion that's ancient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if the people at Exeter are particularly interested in this subject, but I am. So that's why you did. I like I'm more into the New Testament than the Old Testament.
Kind of, a lot of people say that until they read the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
Old Testament.
It's quite boring, the Old Testament, though.
Oh, behave. Seriously. Firstly, it's this big compared to the New Testament, which is this big.
That's what I like.
Secondly, New Testament says the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Which is boring.
Well, it doesn't, because it says it slightly differently and then you have to try and work out what really
happened. That's really interesting.
Yeah. So who wrote was it God who wrote the Bible?
Yeah, no.
No.
Quite
tricky.
It was lots of people.
You're an atheist, a biblical scholar.
Yeah.
You should probably say, what kind of people were they who wrote the Bible? Do we know anything, any idea who they were?
Not really. Well, if you want to talk about the New Testament, we know that Paul was basically, had all sorts of issues. I mean, huge issues. Yeah. Firstly, he was Jewish but was persecuting just a group of Jews, because obviously Christianity started off as a Jewish sect, because Jesus was Jewish, everyone was Jewish. So Paul had his own issues. I think he was basically a frustrated scholar. He was also bald, and he also talks about himself as being stumbling. He couldn't speak very well.
Right.
Publicly. So I think he had various issues. He was quite a short man, I always imagine. Yeah. Short and a bit nervous.
There's nothing wrong with being short.
No, nothing. But I think, you know, it didn't make him feel great.
Okay.
So we know a bit about him.
Yeah.
But basically, he was a bit of a... He liked to say different things to different people when it suited him at different times. Okay. And he spends the whole time saying, but honestly, I know you think this, but I can tell you that I know the way that, you know... Never met Jesus. Never met him.
He met him on the road to Damascus. He came out of the sky and
said... He's got a flash of light in his eyes and he fell over. That's not meeting Jesus.
Best you're going to get now. Unless he can't, he might be back. If he's here, he probably would be in Exeter if he's going to come back. There's the few here that might think they are anyway, let's face it. Well, you wrote a book about God and anatomy.
Yeah, that's coming out next year.
Yeah, so what... What's the anatomy?
So basically, I'm arguing, and this is going to be like a book, rather than a book written for other scholars like me, which only ever get read by about six other people and your PhD students, because you make them read those. It's going to be the kind of book that's in Waterstones and on Amazon and stuff.
I would say I would have read some of your books, but I looked them up on Amazon and they were £35 each, so I thought, fuck it, I'll just ask you about them. They look quite complicated.
Hardback, £60.
Yeah.
I know.
So this is coming out.
Yeah, it's coming out next year, and it's basically arguing about the God of the Bible, so both Hebrew Bible and New Testament. And it's arguing that originally people thought that God had a body, and it's basically what was his body like, and what did it do, and what's different parts, and how come he doesn't have a body anymore, and how has that impacted our own sense of our bodies today?
And is there a whole chapter about his cock? Because that's all that we want to know about.
Babe, there's five chapters about his cock, and they're the longest.
Because I had a question in Christ on a Bike was, you know, how long was Jesus's cock?
Well, Jesus was small because he was circumcised.
Well, that's cutting the end off.
Compared to God, his father, who's...
Well, he's up in heaven, so he's really
enormous.
Big. Yeah.
God's cock was.
Okay.
I've said it so many times.
Well, the baby Jesus, but baby Jesus grew up, and it must have been a certain... But it's an interesting theological question. I think you could write a book about this, because Jesus' cock must have been a certain length, and it must have been God must have sat down and thought, how long is it going to be? Is it going to be a big one because he's God, or does the true Messiah have a humble cock?
Interestingly, like we're not the first. Well, we're not the first people to wonder about this. So Jesus was a good Jew, as I said, and rabbis at the time of Jesus were talking about, well, you know, how do we know what God's penis looks like? And we must know that God's penis was circumcised because we're circumcised, and we're circumcised because our ancestors are circumcised, and they're circumcised because Adam was circumcised, and Adam is circumcised because he was made in the image of God, which means that God was circumcised. So in that sense, Jesus was probably relatively well hung and looked a lot like his divine dad.
Okay. What happened to God's foreskin when they circumcised? Who did it? Did he circumcise himself?
Quite often. So you get in a lot of the Greek myths as well, yeah. and in Greek retellings of Phoenician myths, where the gods basically do circumcise themselves, okay. Which some later Christian theologians tried to imitate people like Origen and supposedly end up castrating themselves accidentally rather than circumcising themselves. Yeah. But I'm sure that's myth. But yeah, so basically...
It's a difficult thing to do for yourself. That's the thing, I think, with... You want someone else to do the circumcision. If you do it yourself, you just get distracted.
Yeah.
You could lose a bit more than you mean to. It does happen sometimes.
But we know what happened to Jesus' foreskin, because there's loads of myths that talk about Jesus' own foreskin, because that's the only detail the Bible gives us about what he looked like. It doesn't tell us, you know, how tall he was, or what colour his hair was, or if he had a beard or not, blah, blah. But the one detail it tells us about his physical body was that he was circumcised when he was 8 days old, which was, you know, Jewish custom. So you get all these myths growing up very quickly after the death of Jesus that talk about what happened to his foreskin.
And there's lots of them around still, aren't there?
There's loads. He had about 10.
Yeah.
And in fact, the latest one that we knew about, it disappeared from a village in Italy in about 1984. And there was a regular festival that was held every year that sort of processed his foreskin around. And because, you know, it's a bit of Jesus, that's fine. So it was a proper relic, but it went missing when the priest in this village where this festival was held, he alerted the police and said, "I've been robbed. The burglars have broken in and they've gone into my wardrobe in my bedroom and they've ransacked the shoebox where I kept Jesus' foreskin for safety." And I think they're, you know, ruffians that have done this. And then all this rumour started up in the Italian press saying that it was dark forces in the Vatican that had stolen Jesus' foreskin.
Yeah. That's they might have thought it was a polo.
Maybe yeah. one of the fruit ones, yeah.
Do you think... Yeah. It's going to be difficult to ask you emergency questions because I wanted to concentrate on the Bible, so I'm trying to adapt some. Do you think God has ever tried to suck his own cock?
I saw you do this with Mary
Beard. Yeah, I'm good at adapting.
No, I think he had lots of other people to do that for him.
Well, he didn't to begin with. He was on his own, wasn't he?
No, but that's what you think, but he wasn't. He wasn't. If you read the Bible in the Hebrew and in the Greek, you can clearly see he wasn't on his own. He had a wife.
Yeah, that's yeah. I wanted to talk about his wife. Yeah. So what was his wife called?
Asherah.
Okay, and why is she not in the Bible? Is she in the Bible at all?
She's mentioned over 40 times in the Bible, but always... She's always vilified, like God always saying, no, don't put that statue of Asherah next to my altar. Don't put that statue of Asherah in my temple. That's very naughty. Right. So it's basically vilifying her as a means of trying to change, edit the past.
Yeah. Or he broke up and he had a bad divorce and didn't want her around anymore.
It was pretty bad. He was pretty horrible to her, yeah.
Yeah. Well, because in the prehistory, like with religions, they were largely either celebrating male and females or quite female-led religions, weren't there? There was a lot of the fecundity of women was the
symbol
of religion.
Yeah, but fertility was just as important for male and masculine deities as it was female. So, yeah, but there were always lots of gods because, it doesn't really make sense. This is the problem that the Bible's got. So you start off with a god who's supposedly on his own, who's so lonely he has to invent people. And then they screw up, obviously, chucks them out of the Garden of Eden. And then he's so lonely again that he has to go and talk to Abraham, who's in Mesopotamia, not even Jewish. He's in Mesopotamia and says, "Will you be my friend? By the way, you need to, you know, circumcise yourself in order to be my friend." So there's this whole kind of... So everything bad that happens is basically because God's a bit sort of... He's just a bit fickle, kind of, you know, he likes people and not that much. I'm going to kill them all with a flood. Oh, no, now I'm going to save them again. Or now I'm going to kill them again.
Yeah.
Whereas in a polytheistic system, so in other words, when you've got lots of deities, all the kind of bad stuff that happens in the cosmos can be blamed on confrontation in the heavens between different groups of gods rather than confrontation between God and humans.
Yeah, makes a lot more sense. That's why
I completely agree.
That's why I'm very Roman. I like the Roman gods. They're my fellas and ladies. you think it's not a very historical book, really, the Bible as it comes. You're saying that none of the... Did Abraham exist as a person?
No.
Human being? Moses didn't exist?
No.
David didn't exist? I've watched your programme. I don't think David existed?
But a lot of scholars would disagree with me about David. But there are some historians... So we know that there's later on some of David's descendants... We know that they existed, so certain kings like Hezekiah and Manasseh and various others. So once you get to like the 8th century BCE, you're kind of on safer ground. But it's just before that it's very improbable.
Yeah. Well, I was watching your hidden Bible.
Bible's Buried Secrets.
Yeah. From a few years ago, and the first one's about David, and there aren't any monuments or any kind of there's one mention of him from about 150 years after he might have lived.
Yeah, so it's one inscription, and a lot of scholars are really excited about it, particularly a lot of Israeli scholars and Jewish scholars and Christian scholars, because, you know, it's one reference to the House of David. So, like, we would talk about the House of Tudor or the House of Stuart in English and Scottish culture, so the House of David. But it's about 150 years later, and, you know, it doesn't prove that David himself existed. You know, I do think that there was a monarchy in Jerusalem, and that perhaps David was a legendary founder, like King Arthur was a legendary founder.
Yeah.
I think it's more of a case of that rather than proof that David was there.
Right. But Moses, you know, how can you say he didn't exist? He was found in the bulrushes. He had an exodus out of Egypt. He parted the Red Sea. Who parted the Red Sea if Moses wasn't there?
Well,
that's
a good
my question to
yeah,
you.
It's a good question. Well, to be completely geeky, in the earliest kind of poem that we have, like the earliest text in the Bible about the parting of the Reed Sea, so it's a misnomer in English translations based on the ancient Greek. So it's actually the Sea of Reeds, not the Red Sea.
That's easier, isn't it?
I know.
I could do that.
So basically, you're talking about a pond.
Yeah.
But in that earliest text, it's a poem, and it's Yahweh, it's God that does the whole dividing up the sea thing, not Moses. But you know, but thing is, Moses is playing lots of other different and important roles, which we ought not to underplay.
Yeah.
You know, for the sake of parity. He was a magician, probably. Yeah. Okay. He's drawn on the idea of a magician. He does all sorts of other stuff. So it's not just the whole sea thing.
No.
Obviously, he's the one that kind of gives people Torah, which is the law or the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, went up a mountain, got the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, it's a pretty important job.
I did a routine, quite a long routine about the Ten Commandments, and went back and looked at the Ten Commandments. And they're quite, when you look at them, they're quite surprising. There's a lot about slavery in there. You'd think that would be, that slavery is kind of okay. You'd think that would be one of the commandments.
They're very Tory. There's a lot about house ownership and possessions and stuff like that as well, which you kind of think,
Yeah. Well, four of them are just about how you've got to say God's brilliant. It's very insecure, those first four.
Yeah.
And they feel really like they've been written by someone's mum and dad, I think. Because the honour thy mother and thy father bit. Yeah, come on, someone slip that in. Just, look, you've got to honour me or...
That's kind of about ancestor worship, though, which is quite interesting. So it's about honouring them because that's the only commandment that has any sort of direct link to about territoriality and landedness. And so there's a sense in which, when it says honour your mother and father, there's a sense in which venerating them, the dead, you know, dead ancestors, will kind of stake your claim to the land. And we know that that's a very common feature of a lot of sort of pre-industrial, pre-monotheism religions. But you're absolutely right. The rest of the Ten Commandments are basically... really like me, please like me, don't do this, don't do that. Even the stuff about, you know, don't envy somebody else's donkey. And, you know, basically God could have written that himself because he was quite jealous.
Yeah. And look after your slaves. Give your slaves a day off. Be nice to your slaves.
There's no slaves in the Ten Commandments.
They are. It's all about the slaves.
No, that's because you're reading it in the context of Exodus, but that didn't really happen.
It says slaves in the one I'm reading. I'm reading the English Bible, the proper one.
Oh, my God. Well, you need to...
I'm reading
we need
proper,
to talk about translations.
I've read the proper English Bible written by
King James.
English God. I believe he's English. I know with the New Testament, there's a lot of apocryphal texts that didn't make it in.
Yeah.
Is that true of the Old Testament as well?
There's loads of stuff that didn't make it into the Old Testament.
Why? Like, how do they? What are the reason things didn't make it in? And what is the maddest stuff that didn't make it in? Because there's some mad stuff about Jesus.
In the New Testament, some of the maddest stuff is that when he was a child, Jesus was a child killer, which is my favourite story. So quite a lot of the early Gospels and Epistles that didn't make it into the final collection talk about Jesus basically discovering his powers as he's growing up. And one of the things he does is that he goes up onto the roof with a load of other kids and pushes one of the children off and kills him and then brings him back to life again just because he can.
You would.
Which he would, of course. When he helps his dad, Joseph, the carpenter, out in his carpentry shop and sort of like lengthens bits of wooden stuff for him. He does things like, you know, creates clay sparrows and that kind of thing and brings them to life and then kills them again. He does a lot of killing and to the point where parents complain to Jesus's mum and say, your son is killing our children. You've got to do something about him. So those are some of the stories that don't get in.
And do you turn all the kids into goats or something?
Yeah, he turns a lot of kids into animals.
Yeah.
But then later on, some of the other apocryphal stories about grown-up Jesus is that when, after he's resurrected and then ascended to heaven, he suddenly appears in the marital, in the kind of the bridal suite of this couple that have just got married.
Because you would.
And starts telling them not to have sex. Wow. And basically saying that the vagina and the breasts are demonic and that there's no way that they should be penetrated.
Because that was the good thing about Jesus, he died so young, but then he carried on living, got middle-aged and went mad, didn't he? That's what happened to a lot of my friends. They started saying, getting their 50s, start saying stuff like that. And so why are those things not in because someone went, oh, no, that's crazy, we can't have those in? Or is it, who made that decision about what goes into the Bible and the New Testament?
Yeah, well, we don't know who made the decision. There's a tradition that the decision was made by a group of bishops, like in about sort of a third-ish century. But we don't really know. That's just legend. Basically, the reason why some things go in and some things don't is because some things just were more popular than others. So this is the beginning of what we call the Codex or the book. So before that, things were written on wax tablets or boards or on papyrus scrolls or leather scrolls. And by this point, you start to get the beginnings of a codex, which is like what we know as a folded book. So that made literature much more able to travel. It was much more mobile. So the four Gospels, for example, as we have them in the New Testament, they seem to have been the ones that got really popular really quickly across lots of different communities around, you know, Syria and Palestine and obviously the Mediterranean and stuff. But then there were others that were really, really popular, but then not so much because morally or ethically they were a bit dodge, like, you know, like Jesus killing other kids and stuff, but more because, you know, they may not have just had the kind of patronage that some of this other literature had. So without a rich backer, you don't get published.
Because someone's just copying them all out by hand in a cave somewhere. Is that basically how it works?
No, they weren't cave dwellers. They were very sophisticated people.
They hid them in caves.
They did hid the Dead Sea Scrolls in caves, and then they hid some of the Nag Hammadi texts, some of these New Testament texts, were admittedly put on a rubbish dump. Yeah. But, you know, yeah.
Okay, good. I'm quite obsessed with the genealogy of Christ, and I've learned it all off by heart and can do it backwards and forwards.
Which is more than Jesus can do.
How many of those are real? So if we Abraham begat Isaac, neither of them real. Isaac begat Jacob. Jacob begat Judas's brethren. Judas begat Phares and Zara of Tamar. Phares begat Ezrom. Ezrom begat Aram. Aram begat Aminadab.
You're good at that.
Aminadab begat Booz of Rakab. Is he Booz of Rakab? I love Booz of Rakab. my favourite one. Booz begat Obed of Rufo, begat Jesse. Jesse begat David the King. David the King begat Solomon of Herod, been the wife of Arias. Solomon begat Rehoboam.
Rehoboam, no.
Oh, come on, that's a good name.
No, yeah, but it's a good name, but no.
Yeah, Rehoboam begat Asa. Asa begat Abi. Abi begat Jotham. Jotham begat...
Jotham.
I've missed out Ozias, I think. Ozias, Jotham, Jotham. Gonna start again. This sometimes happens when I get to that stage. So how far down do we get to? Who's the first real one? Is Jeconias and his brethren about the time they were taken away to Babylon? After they were taken to Babylon, Jeconias begat Salathe, or Salathe begat Zorobabel. Zorobabel begat Abiathar.
Yeah,
Abiathar
once they're away into Babylon, you're
do you not have to learn this?
Was
on the first day of university of biblical studies.
Bible
go.
School.
Do you know the first page of Matthew?
No.
Well, don't fuck off back until you've learned this. Richard Herring knows it, more or less, and he can do that.
But I will show my students this and say this is what's possible.
Is Joseph real?
I'm not. I don't
is
know
Jesus
about
real?
Jesus, probably, yeah, and probably his mum, Mary or Miriam or Mariam or however whatever she was called. But yeah, probably. But you know, and there are other figures in that genealogy that probably are real. I mean, that genealogy is deliberately trying to make him out to have royal descent, so that's why he comes through David and everything. But which is the weird thing, isn't it? Obviously, because it's trying to give him royal descent through his paternal line.
Yeah.
But then we find out that Joseph's not his dad.
Exactly.
Which is one of the first theological problems.
Yeah. Also, if you go back that many generations, Danny Dyer's related to royalty, isn't he? Yeah. So it doesn't mean anything.
I believe that. And then my friend Adam Rutherford has said that basically we're all related to
royalty. Yeah, of course, because you go back that far. There weren't millions of people back in the past, were there? So the minute you get back 16, 20 generations, everyone, if you can trace it, that's quite impressive. But then when they found Richard the third under the car park.
Love him. Do you know what? My sister, I love her to bits, but my sister, the day that they made that announcement about Richard III being discovered under the car park, she texted me and she said, but why did they bury him under a car park? Like, she meant it in all seriousness, and it was the funniest thing she's ever said to me.
It's good.
That's true.
But they did DNA testing on him, and some of them didn't match up because obviously everyone was fucking around, weren't they?
Yeah.
Look at Princess Diana. So. She didn't do that, and that is the one person who proves the rule.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So, I know you're more... I mean, what's the... Well, let's talk about the Old Testament.
Yay.
I mean, you know, that all those people I know who don't exist, I've wasted my time learning their names. What do you think... I mean, What do you think is the craziest thing in the Old Testament out of all the stories in the Old Testament?
The craziest?
Yeah.
Oh my God, there's so many. I mean, there's Ezekiel, God telling Ezekiel that he has to cook on human poo and then eat it.
Right.
Just because he makes him. There's things like, one of my favourite stories is, it's Elisha and the bears, which is in the Book of Kings. And Elisha's bald. This is not an attack on bald men. This is just a...
Have a go at the bald, just leave the short guys alone. That's what I'm saying.
So being bald in the ancient world was basically the equivalent of I suppose it has similarities to some sort of polemics today, but you weren't considered to be particularly hyper masculine. And so Elisha's walking along and he's bald. And to be a proper like man in the ancient world, you had to be like tall and hairy and kind of have a red face and a big beard and stuff like that. And Elisha's just some guy who's got no hair. And so these little kids come running out of Bethel and they go, ha, baldy, baldy, baldy. So they basically might as well have been saying, you've got a limp dick.
Yeah.
It's basically the same thing. And so basically God's not without a sense of irony. So because it's an attack on Elisha's masculinity and his hairlessness, he decides to call out a load of female hairy bears from the forest, which always makes me laugh. And they maul the children and they shred 42 of them. 42 kids. Which is kind of crazy because you think it's a bit of an overreaction.
Yeah.
Just for calling to saying that somebody's got no hair and,
yeah.
and might
kids
be
kids don't come out of the, you know, kids have a hard time, don't they? King Herod.
I know. Well, they did have a tough time with Herod. But yeah. Herod's just trying to kind of... Firstly, Herod was very insecure. He probably existed.
Yeah.
And he was very insecure because he was of mixed parentage. And we all, you know, speaking from experience, it's very hard being mixed parentage sometimes. And so he...
Have you killed a load of kids and you just, is this what we're leading up to?
To be fair.
Every now and again, you just kill your friend's
there's
children.
There's time. But he's got issues. And so he's trying to... It's his own kind of ethnic cleansing. So I'm not saying that the actual killing of the children is historical, but Herod was. So he's got all sorts of issues going on. But that's quite a powerful story. But the thing is, Herod, or the story writer, is riffing off the idea that it was God himself that had killed a whole load of firstborn Egyptian babies back with Moses and the Exodus.
Right.
So you get this like repetition of motifs. So yeah, Herod probably wasn't as bad as we think he is. I always felt very sorry for Herod in the Nativity.
I mean, he's a bad guy in the Nativity. I mean, I think if these things are happening,
yeah.
I mean, but they're not meant. It's not meant to be history when it's the readers of it aren't reading it as history in the originally, right? But if a star was appearing in the sky indicating a single dwelling in a village, I mean, that stars are pretty big, and it would have to be quite low down to point at one. You'd think that would have made some other history book somewhere in the world going, oh, there was that time when that star came and I don't know what it was doing, but it didn't bother following it. seemed a waste of time. So, I mean, these stories can't have happened, surely, because they would have made, you know, most of them are so incredible that somebody else would have gone, oh, there was that great time when the...
Yeah, but the thing is, like, I always say to my students that the biblical writers, they're not trying to deceive their audience. They're not trying to lie. It's just that they had a very different way. Like, ancient people had a very different way of seeing the world and interpreting what was real and what wasn't real than we do. And that's not to say that they were stupid. It's just that they just had a different understanding of what history was. So they think that there's this amazing man who was crucified, and they decided. So that's the earliest Christian writings we have are in Paul's writings in the New Testament. He doesn't mention Jesus' birth or life at all. All that he cares about is that Jesus died and was resurrected and is God. So you get all this kind of filler having to come. We're like, well, how come? You know, who was he? So the Gospels are written after Paul's writing. So that's when you get the kind of embellishment of, oh, yeah, you know, well, he was from Galilee. And that's and in the biblical world, Galilee was where all the stupid people came from.
Right.
So it's a bit of a cuss, like, to start with, to say that, you know, that's where Jesus was from. And so you get all this kind of embellishment. And so you end up saying, well, he must have been born to this special life and death.
Right.
And so that, of course, he would have had this kind of heavenly star over his birthplace.
Yeah. And they're trying to fulfill Old Testament prophecies within what they're writing.
Yeah.
So they'll make things, I think, like in the story where the guy gets his ear cut off in Gethsemane. That they give him a name, which you think, no one would have said, by the way, mate, before we go on, what was your name so I can write that in the book? Yeah, exactly. But his name, because his name's given because it fulfills a prophecy about someone with that name, I think.
Yeah, and so it is that kind of thing that the biblical writers, because they were Jewish, the first Christians were Jewish, and so you have to have a sense that these written traditions in Judaism, ancient Judaism, were so important that you can't suddenly have this guy sort of saying, I think that guy Jesus that was crucified, you know, as a criminal, and whose body's probably been thrown into a mass grave, which is what happened to criminals' bodies when they were executed and taken down.
Yeah.
So you can't have somebody, you know, just say that he was a nobody. You have to sort of say, well, I think our ancestors kind of knew that something like this was going to happen. And so, of course, you're going to rake through the past to find evidence to support it.
Sure. And it doesn't feel to me like, even in the Bible, that Jesus was trying to start up a new religion. He was very concerned with Judaism and reforming Judaism, maybe, and pointing out where Judaism was wrong. But that doesn't seem the actions of someone who's trying to create a new religion.
Spinning in his grave if he knew what was going on in his name. So, yeah, he definitely wasn't. He was a good Jew. He was quite a ferocious Jew. But, you know, he was, you know, it may be that if he wasn't married, we don't know, but if he wasn't married, he may have been a part of this John the Baptist kind of desert dwelling ascetic cult that kind of, you know, didn't want to have any worldly possessions. And there were all sorts of people like that, different religious groups like that in Judaism and outside of it at the time. So I think he was, I think he was a bit of a geezer. And I think probably him going in, you know, the thing that gets him arrested is when he goes to Jerusalem at Passover, which, you know, any kind of festival, I mean, just look at Exeter at Christmas, same thing. You know, any kind of festival, heightened tensions and everyone's a bit, you know, giddy. He goes into the temple and he kicks off the temple and, like, kicks over tables and all that kind of stuff. That's exactly the kind of shit that will get you arrested by the Romans. So he probably did that, you know, he or his followers probably did that, but not because they're trying to kind of claim that the temple is about to be usurped because, you know, Jesus' body is going to replace the temple, but because they were, you know, kicking off about the kind of things that protesters kick off about today.
Mm-hmm. He would just write a review on TripAdvisor like the people do now about Exeter Cathedral's charging £12 to get in. I'm pretty pissed off about that one star. And if he'd done that, they'd had TripAdvisor back then, he'd probably still be alive today. That's the tragedy of it all. What brought you to Exeter? Did you do something wrong in your academic career that you had to come to Exeter?
I got a job and thought I would leave after a couple of years. Yeah. But it turned out that my colleagues are quite nice, most of them.
Okay. Is it nice here, Exeter? It's a long way, isn't it? It's a long way from all the important stuff.
I grew up in London, yeah. So yeah, I do find it. It's beautiful living here. It really is. And it's like going on safari every time you drive anywhere. It's like there's sheep and cows and stuff everywhere, which I really enjoy. But yeah, yeah. It's what I do like. 50%
less car accidents than anywhere else in the country in Exeter.
That's because there's always sheep on the road. It is. So
there are no cars here. It's cars. Let's get back to... I thought I'd just diss Exeter for a bit, but no, they didn't like it. This stuff worked brilliantly in Plymouth. Loved it. And so I'm sort of interested in the way religion became very patriarchal and became very male-based, which is basically because of the Bible, right? And it's sort of that's what turned... Religions were matriarchal or celebrating.
Well, no.
Do you not think so?
No, because let me preface this by saying I am a feminist, but there was a big feminist movement within a lot of academia in the 1970s and 80s that basically argued that, in terms of history of religions, that religion started off as being very matriarchal and it was all about the celebration of the female body. And that basically, as soon as writing started, accountancy, which was how writing was invented, it was basically trying to keep a track of who had what and who bartered what for what. It became very anal and very patriarchal. But I think that's a very fake... It's a very fake dichotomy to draw between like this matriarchy and patriarchy stuff. I think there's always been a very gender fluid idea of what deities and divinities are. So you've got, it's a scale, you know, very, very, very masculine and very, very, very feminine and yeah. Everything in between. And so I think it was less that it was matriarchal and then became patriarchal and more that it was always about reflecting human communities and human, you know, small communities in yeah. which you obviously have a mix of people and a mix of genders. And gradually, as time went on, I think probably as writing became more important to authorizing power, and basically once temples start to become cities rather than just temples, I think that's when you get a shift towards a more masculinized idea of power. So you've still got goddesses and sort of genderqueer deities and all sorts, but you tend to have the big... The one with the power is a more masculine deity.
Yeah. But did these religions that all sprung up around that time and that we still have now, do you think they have influenced the patriarchal nature of
yes,
our society?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, as soon as the Bible becomes an authoritative text or a bit of the Bible, so whether it's Torah, which is the first five books of the Bible... Yeah. Or whether it's the Hebrew scriptures or the New Testament or the Quran, as soon as you get a collection of texts that become authoritative, not just religiously, but socially and culturally, and the Bible, whether we like it or not, is still a cultural icon in the West today, whether we believe it or not. So, yeah, it's got a very masculinized understanding of what the divine is. And, you know, and God, whether it's Allah or whether it's Yahweh or whether it's God or Theos in the New Testament, he's a guy.
Yeah.
And that means that human men are like God in ways that human women are not like God.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. It's good. It's a good point. It's a good point. How you put it that way, yeah, is that they were right to... I mean, and again, Paul didn't seem to like women very much.
No.
Well, I reckon Jesus probably liked women. That's my guess.
I'm not sure about Jesus, because it looks like there probably was something going on with him and whatever the Mary, whoever the Mary Magdalene figure yeah. is based on.
Yeah.
You know, because he had
women.
Did
you study the Da Vinci Code in part yeah. of your part of your
core, that's core reading? Be main, core reading. Yeah. But yeah, he had a lot of women in his following, and yeah. it was probably the women that supported and paid financially for his little movement to exist. But I think Paul is somebody, you know, Paul thought that basically the world was about to end, like any minute, literally yeah. any minute. So he thought there's no point in having sex, because there's no point in having children, because the heavenly realm is about to crash into the earthly realm and like sweep the whole earthly realm away. we're all the righteous ones that believe in Jesus are all going to get swept up into this new heavenly realm where we're not even going to have bodies, like proper bodies anymore. We're going to be asexual. So there won't be any sex in heaven. And God's like, that's what you think. Because he's been doing it for centuries. But anyway, that's in the book. So when the end of the world doesn't happen, so Paul spent all this time saying there's no point in having sex. It's like, we don't need children.
Yeah.
So he keeps telling everybody to abstain from sex and not get married. Or if you do want to have sex, get married, but don't have sex too often. So the world doesn't end, and yet Christians still keep believing and Christians still keep having kids. And so you're kind of like, what's the deal with the whole sex thing and the marriage thing?
Yeah. See, I'm the opposite of Paul. If the heavens are about to crash into the earth, I'd say that'd be a good reason to have loads of sex with people that aren't my wife. So
there are some estimates that say that it'll probably take about half an hour for the heavens to crash into
the
earth.
That's enough. That's a lot. Like, you know, I can get 4 or 5 in by that time. But like, also, if it's going to, you know, that's the great time. There's no repercussions to sex, is there, if the world's going to end? What's he thinking? Paul's a fucking idiot.
Well, Paul was, because, like, he was... And the thing is, Paul was Jewish. And actually, ancient Jewish attitudes to sex were far more, like, liberal attitudes than Christian attitudes came to be. So they were far more... It was all about pleasure. Sex was all about... I mean, obviously, you know, don't deliberately go and kind of screw over a lot of people, literally, literally. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was much more... It was about female pleasure as well as male pleasure and stuff like that, whereas Christians just got such a massive hang-up about it so quickly.
Yeah.
And that's mostly to do with Paul and then Augustine. St. Augustine, who basically says that, you know, women and their vaginas are the gateway to hell.
Mm. In a good way, though. Mm. Again, I just put a different spin on both those guys. But St. Augustine was... Wasn't he the one that was fucking everyone and then went at the end, give me chastity, but not yet? Was he that guy?
Yeah, he had quite a... He basically shagged his way around North Africa for
some
time.
He was a good guy. There should be more saints like that. Not Francis of Assisi with animals. What a waste of time. So with your... Because it is obviously a history you're looking at. So you go to these places and you're doing archaeology and looking at the archaeology there. Is that that's all part of your job?
Yeah.
Yeah. What places have you... Which kind of religious places have you been to and seen?
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah. Where have you been?
Everywhere, all across the Middle East. And now, but the places that I love the most have now been destroyed since ISIS kind of rampaged across Syria. And that's devastating.
Yeah.
I mean, properly flattened. I mean, obviously, huge amount of human life has been lost in Syria. So I was last there in 2010, just a few months before the war in Syria started. And since then, just... The most, I mean, we're not just talking about Palmyra here, which was obviously a really important site, but is particularly well known for its Greco-Roman monuments. But we're talking about, you know, temples and sacred places that have been standing since like the 14th century BCE, like the 16th century BCE. And they've just been absolutely flattened, as well as the museums being looted and plundered and smashed. And it's just devastating.
Yeah.
Like, properly devastating.
But it's sort of, it's weird, isn't it, that all these books are the reason, you know, if all this stuff is essentially made up and it's about trying to, you know, create a history and create a property rights, and all these books are still 2,000 years on creating these situations, and there doesn't seem to be any way out of making people, you know, you can't go to ISIS and say, by the way, all of that's made up, that stuff.
Yeah, definitely not me.
No. I'll give it a go. Listen, fellas, just calm down. It's sort of weird. They couldn't have I mean, if they thought the world was going to end anyway, they wouldn't have predicted. But it's incredible to think that we're still so in the sway of those stories from so long ago, from such a specific region.
Yeah, I mean, and I understand that the past matters, and I understand that cultural heritage, whether it's religious or social or whatever, I understand that matters. Of course, it does, but at the same time, I think we need to recognise that whether it's the Quran or the Bible or Tanakh, these texts are human products. They're not divine products. They didn't fall out of the sky. And we need to be able to treat them not necessarily irreverently. And I know I've not exactly modelled that particularly well tonight. But you know, we need to be able to treat them like human. They tell us more about who we are than they can ever possibly tell us about who the gods are or yeah. what God wants. And I think if we approach them like that, then actually more of us will understand those texts, and maybe we could end up having a conversation one day with ISIS leaders.
The extreme Christians are probably more of a problem than for us in our society than anyone that ISIS are ever going to be, aren't they?
Oh my God, definitely. Yeah. You look at it in terms of terrorism. Obviously, in the Western world, there's much more extremist right wing Christian stuff going on than there is anything else. Even in Devon, it's the animal rights activists who I quite proudly support, who are the terrorist ones, in a place.
Hey,
like this.
Come on, the bloke tried to take out giraffe. If he just wait, if he'd waited 10 years, it would just gone bust anyway. And how do you, I've seen you talk about this a little bit, but as a woman working in academia, when I watched your YouTube, your show on YouTube, I made the mistake of looking at the comments.
I never do that.
Yeah, well, it wasn't me, so it doesn't matter. To me, I could look at it, but it's brilliant. Is it difficult then with that show, is it more difficult to be taken seriously as a woman on TV and as an academic?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And even if it wasn't TV, it's still harder to be taken seriously as a woman in academia, just because no matter how, we read in the press all the time that our universities are stuffed full of like liberal lefty academics who are all very, and there are a lot of nice people that I work with in academia, but there are also a load of dinosaurs that do think that I'm A, not clever, but because I'm a woman and atheist, and B, that I'm not particularly, I've only got to become a professor or got to my position because I slept with somebody or I got a nice smile or whatever.
Yeah.
So you get that shit all the time. And at conferences as well, people constantly. I had one guy at a conference, a massive conference in America, tell me I was the Kim Kardashian of biblical studies. And he thought it was a compliment.
And do you think, is the sexism, because as an atheist, that's kind of weird, right? But that a lot of people who study biblical studies are coming from a religious point of view. Mm. And so it's sort of weird that they would do that. To me, is the weird thing that you could come in with a prejudice, in a sense that you're studying something. And even that show about Paul, you can see the people who are desperately trying to make the facts fit into the religion rather than looking at it as an academic exercise. So is being an atheist within biblical studies a handicap as well, or is that?
I mean, intellectually, I don't think it's a handicap at all. Obviously, I think that it's a great thing, but. But yeah, in terms of my profession and my career, it is really difficult because most academics and senior academics are religious in one way. But a lot of people are very supportive of what I do, and some academics who are religious do this thing where they kind of separate out their confessional life from their professional life, or at least they think that's what they're doing.
Right.
But it never really turns out that way. So you end up, you read these texts, the biblical texts or whatever, with an inevitable bias. But yeah. I think being an atheist, I don't know, someone called me double trouble because I was a woman and an atheist. Right. It's like, seriously? Like, seriously? So I do think it's a bit harder.
Yeah. And Anne Widdecombe doesn't particularly care
for you. She hates me.
Yeah. So you've... Because you go on these Nikki Campbell discussion shows every now and again, and you come and Anne Widdecombe... I mean, it's sort of interesting when someone is that... That they won't even countenance the idea of someone questioning
anything.
Exactly. So I suppose is what faith is, but it sort of seems weird to me that you would believe something and then not want to just check the facts of it, or run it by yourself every now and again.
And in a way, the biblical writers almost kind of model that much better approach, like both in the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament. The fact you've got four different Gospels telling the same story but completely differently suggests that those biblical compilers and writers were much more comfortable with contradiction than we are as readers today. And you get exactly the same thing happening in the Hebrew Bible as well. Like, the book of Job is all about, the whole point is to question God. Like, seriously, you're completely screwing me over. And the idea that you explore that and you test it and you challenge it, But someone like Anne Widdecombe, she really struggled with that. Should I tell you my favourite Anne Widdecombe story?
Yes,
when I did
do.
That TV thing with her.
Yeah.
So we filmed this TV thing and she was interviewing me and I basically said Moses didn't exist and the Exodus didn't happen. And she called me a militant atheist, which was hilarious because like I kind of think of militants as like having bombs strapped to them and stuff like that. And I was in a pair of very nice heels. and then afterwards, we were waiting after we'd done the filming. There were these two posh cars waiting to take Anne back off to whatever parliamentary do she had to go to and me back to Paddington Station. So I get in my car and the driver says, oh, yeah, he says, because he could see Anne Widdecombe getting in the car in front. He said, yeah, she's off the telly, isn't she? And I said, oh, yeah, she's, you know, that politician. And he went, yeah, that's that Mo Molam, innit? So I just said, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I met Mo Molam at Jules Holland's Hootenanny. I sat on the same table as in the pretend Hootenanny when it's November. And yeah, you're pretending it's not. And then I watched myself on New Year's Eve and I was on my own.
On your own.
Watched myself having a good time while I cried. So, well, we're coming to the end. I'll just get a couple of more. I'm not going to ask you any emergency questions any more than the God suck his own cock one, which is awful. Sorry.
Which I didn't answer.
You didn't. I reckon, I mean, the question is, he must have thought about doing it. He could do it, couldn't he? Definitely could do it, because he could just magic it so he could do it. And if he could do it, he's done it. That's my belief. Isn't one of the gods just the snakes eating its own tail anyway? That's something, isn't it? It's basically, that's what God
is. That's like the never-ending story, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, maybe. Adam and Eve always confuse me. Let's start at the beginning, and then we'll work through Genesis.
Right. Yeah.
Because Cain and Abel, and then one of them kills the other one.
Yeah, Cain kills Abel.
And how do they produce more children anyway after Adam and Eve have some kids?
Well, one theory is that it's God that fathers the first child anyway with Eve. It's
Sweet.
Not Adam. And then the Cain has sex with Eve. That's one theory.
Okay. Not nice, is it?
No.
A lot of stuff like that on Pornhub at the moment. It's not... I don't like it, but I can make it work, but I have to I just have to imagine them as actors pretending. but Adam has another wife and stuff like this, isn't it?
Well, later Jewish tradition says that originally Eve wasn't Adam's first wife.
Right.
The first wife was Lilith, who, and this is again one of my favourite early, so this is a rabbinic story, so early, so about time of Jesus. So the idea is that God makes Adam. So first, God makes all the animals for Adam to have a partner, and Adam's like, "No, I don't have sex with that. No, I don't have sex with that." And he says, "Okay, well, I'll make you a woman." And Adam's like, "Okay." So the first woman is actually Lilith, who her and Adam break up because she wants to be on top during sex,
right.
And he says, "No, I'm the man. I need to be on top." And she basically says, "Screw you." She says, "If you're not going to let me go on top, like, at least half the time, then I'm going to end this relationship." And so she flies off over the wall and then becomes a baby killer. And then, this is just this Jewish myth, and then so God makes Eve out of Adam's
own rib
or side or body. One scholar claims that it's his penis bone that is Eve's kind of spine.
Sweet.
Because apparently monkeys have them. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
So, but does if they hadn't eaten the apple?
It wasn't an apple.
Okay.
It just says fruit.
They hadn't eaten the fruit.
Yeah.
I like to think of it as an apple. Then what would have happened? No one would have had sex except for...
No, they probably were having sex in the garden because the Hebrew, when you read it, it does kind of imply that they were already having sex in the garden anyway.
Okay.
So they would have had sex and had babies, but everyone would have lived in God's garden and been gardeners.
That would have been much better.
Yeah, it's like kind of Kew Gardens. Yeah.
But I saw something you were saying that you think Eden is the church, in
temple.
Jerusalem.
Yeah. I think it's drawn on that image. So the idea is that temple is a meeting place between the heavenly realm and the earthly realm. Temple's built on the top of a mountain because they always are. And basically, it's about cultivated fertility, and the temple was full of all these kind of sacred trees and herbs and medicines that you could grow and kind of offer up to the gods. And so that seems to be what the temple story in, what the creation story in Genesis is riffing off.
Okay. And Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
Is there anything in any of the other texts about how Noah managed to get all the animals together and sex them and go to Africa and find stuff that didn't exist already? Or is it just...
I think...
Because I feel like if I was writing that story, I'd put in a bit more detail about that. Yeah. That's the interesting bit. If you're writing the film, and then I found some giraffes, and then I found...
Yeah.
And some elephants.
I think because it's kind of... When you read the Noah story in Genesis, it's only like three chapters, but then there's two different versions of the story, and in one version, it's just like a pair of each animals. And then in the other version, it's like seven pairs of kosher animals and two pairs of unkosher animals.
Okay.
So it's almost like someone has put in the thought about, we need a bit more detail, but they've not kind of done the zoological detail that we might expect, more the kind of culinary.
Did Noah exist?
No.
Oh, come on, he must
no,
have.
No, it is based on a much older myth, okay. So a much older Sumerian myth.
Okay.
So, no, he still didn't exist, but it's a very old story.
Okay. I like the Sumerian gods. That's Enki is one of the Sumerian gods.
Enki's a dude.
He masturbates into make rivers.
Yeah, he basically lies on his back in the marshlands in Iraq the whole time with a massive erection and just waits for passing goddesses to come by. But then it turns a bit horrible because he ends up raping a series of his own daughters and granddaughters and great-granddaughters.
That is a bit horrible, yeah.
Yeah, so again, it takes a dark turn.
It's that got into Pornhub again. well, look, it's been fascinating to talk to you. The people of Exeter are stunned by what they've had. It's Sunday. We've got to talk about religion. If it's wrong to talk about God sucking his own cock on Sunday, I want to know. I don't want to be right. So this is coming out in 2020, so your book will be out this year.
Yeah.
In Waterstones. Yeah. And is it called?
It's called God and Anatomy.
Right.
And there's a lot of pictures as well as words.
Wow.
And cock.
Good. Just random ones or to do with the subject?
No, mainly divine. Yeah, mainly divine, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause, Professor Francesca Stavrakopoulou. Thank you. Come back next week. You can come in for free. See you after the break.
You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Professor Francesca Stavrakopoulou. The music is by Pest. I would like to thank everyone at the beautiful Exeter Corn Exchange. What a lovely venue. It doesn't look it from the outside, but it's beautiful on the inside. Thank you to everyone at Go Past the Stripe, of course, especially Chris Evans, not that one. And also everyone at ACAST, British Comedy Guide. You know the drill. I don't have to thank them every time, they're motherfuckers! I would also like to thank my producer, James Hingley, my series producer, Ben Walker, who I'm indebted to, and of course, most of all, the person who did the most on this episode, my executive producer, Josh McMillan. Great guy. The Joshka, we call him on set. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. Why not head to GoFasterStrike.com to get badges, monthly badges with membership packs and all lots of extras, or DVDs, or downloads, or emergency questions books. Go to richhang.com/gigs to find out if I'm coming to a place near you with Rahulastapa. Rahulastapa, stop saying that, you people over there.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.